entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
Look out there. Out there is the perfect lap. You see it?
I think so.
Most people can't.
Carroll Shelby.
Maybe.
Lee Iacocca, Ford Motor.
Suppose Henry Ford II wanted to build the greatest race car the world's ever seen to win the 24 hours of Le Mans. What's it take?
Well, it takes something money can't buy.
Money can buy speed.
What in about speed?
You need a pure racer behind the wheel of your car. That's Ken Miles.
I don't trust him an inch.
We heard he's difficult.
No, Ken's a puppy dog.
No. Whatever it is, Shell, no.
Trust me.
You're gonna build a car to beat Ferrari with a Ford.
Correct.
And how long did you tell them that you needed? 200-300 years?
90 days.
This isn't the first time Ford Motors has gone to war. We know how to do more than push paper. Go ahead, Carol. Go to war.
Thank you, sir.
Do you think you can beat Ferrari?
I can try.
We're lighter, we're faster. That don't work, we're nastier.
We're gonna make history.
You ready?
I was born ready, Mr. Shelby. Hit it.
Hey, sports fans. Peter Brock here from BRE Racing and AeroVault Trailers. Listen to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, the best automobile show in the Southeast.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio with Cars, and I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers at GoogleTanTalk1340.com, and you can see us live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us. And if you miss any of our past shows, don't forget to check out NostalgicRadioandCars.com. Tonight is 730 shows over a 14-year-plus time. Time flies. Hey. Time really flies. But anyway, so we got a very special guest for you this evening. We have part two with the lovely Pat Bondurant. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about what she's got going on. And then, of course, about some of the stuff that people don't all know about the legendary race car driver, Bob Bondurant, her husband. And now we played a little clip there to Ford versus Ferrari. And like we mentioned once before, and we've talked about this a few times on the show, that was a very good movie, and it showed kind of the relationship between Carol Shelby and Ken Miles specifically. And there was a lot of Hollywood in it, but there was a lot of truth, but there was also a lot of stuff that they left out. So, and I know there's a documentary on it out there, and I haven't seen the documentary version of it yet, I don't think. Maybe I did, and I just forgot, but, you know, when you get older, memories like, I don't know what I had for lunch. But at any rate, so along those lines, the parallel that I always draw is like Bob Bondurant, for example, and Dan Gurney and Phil Hill, probably some of the finest race car drivers that America's ever produced, okay? And extremely competitive, and they race not only in GT and open wheel and Formula One and all over the world. They were just very, very versatile drivers. You know, you have other drivers like Mario Andretti and Pernelli Jones, really rawhide kind of guys. But the guys that truly had finesse were Bob Bondurant, Dan Gurney, and Phil Hill. And they have a certain following. But they weren't really always in the limelight. And, you know, Ken Miles had a relationship with Carol Shelby, no different than Roger Penske and Mark Donohue, and there was a lot of, you know, and Hans Herrmann with, let's say, Porsche, for example, and then later obviously Vic Alford and Derek Bell and people like that throughout the 70s, and so there was that relationship. But Ken Miles worked pretty much in house with Carol Shelby, as did with all the R&D and the testing and stuff, And Penske, same thing with Donohue. He worked in house, you know. And I'm going to use those two because that was the classic Ford versus Chevy rival versus Ferrari. And back in the day, Kennedy, I keep saying that wrong. I should, you know, Luigi's probably going to come over and slap me one day and drop a bowl of spaghetti on my head or something. But so Kennedy was kind of like to Ferrari, like Miles to Shelby, and Donohue to Penske, and although there was countless Ferrari drivers, but you know, some of them had very, very close relationships with their founders, and so we're going to focus on Bob Bondurant tonight. I think that's kind of important. One of the things I would talk about too this past weekend, I want a big shout out to my friends over there at Festivals of Speed. We had a really, really good turnout over there, and I met some real interesting people over there at the Festivals of Speed at the World Equestrian Center in Ocala. And one guy in particular, his name was, we'll keep his name quiet. But anyway, he has a collection of interesting cars, and he had reached out to me. And you just don't know how many, there's a lot of car guys out there. There really is, a lot of car collectors. And but there was another gentleman there that had a 61 Ferrari 250 GT. And GTE, excuse me. And I have it was more of a survivor car. And, you know, me being the ex-junkyard guy, you know, I've never really had any nice cars. I shouldn't say that because I did buy a few new cars back in the 80s, back in the day, and usually Porsches or something like that. I still have my original Ford Bronco that I bought new at Bill Curry Ford, one owner. And so I kept that. I still have my little Harley shorts that I bought new in 1972. One owner, and I still have my Schwinn bicycle that I bought new in 1966. One owner. Okay, so I have a few, but none of these vehicles are perfect. They're all, you know, driver quality, and because I drove them. And but anyway, so I got to talking to this one guy, and there was a number of people there, but this guy in particular was very interesting because he not only had the Ferrari 250 GTE, but he also had two others. He had a really, really nice one, and he had a parts car. And then we started talking about Alfa Romeos, and then we started talking about some other cars, Italian cars that he had. I think he had possibly a Maserati 3500, which is also a very interesting early 60s car. So he's clearly a classic car guy. And, you know, when you meet somebody, they, you know, and most, I always am thrilled to when you meet people and they're not boisterous, you know, they're just kind of like a matter of fact, and they just kind of talk casual about what they have, and they're not necessarily want to give out the information that, oh, I have this, but they say, well, yeah, I also have one of these. And of course, my favorite line is just like, I should have played that clip, is, what else do you have in the garage? What else do you have in the garage? So what else do you have besides that? But I do it in such a way that it's not, I'm not asking you to brag necessarily, even reveal, just tell me what else you have, and I can kind of read between the lines. You know, be car guy, it's kind of a car guy vibe thing, you know. People that own European cars have a little different mindset than people that own American cars. And, you know, you have the Ferrari crowd, you have the Lamborghini crowd, but the vintage car guy is different than the modern supercar guy. You know, there's a different philosophy there. And it's kind of like the nouveau car guy that, you know, that became affluent, and, you know, he's got a stunning Aston Martin, or he's got a stunning Lamborghini, whatever it might be, and as well as a Ferrari or a McLaren or something like that. And those cars are, and I understand it because there was a gentleman there that I met that had an Aston Martin, he had a Jag, he had a Ferrari also, but all late model cars, and a Porsche, a GT2, or 3 rather. And I said, no vintage cars? He says, well, I've had them in the day, but I don't want, I want nice new cars with no problems these days. So he basically keeps his cars, very cool exotics, in a climate control garage, and when they're out of warranty, he says, c'est la vie, and just goes and buys something else. But all his cars are meticulously maintained. He's truly a car collector. And he says, at this stage in my life, I'm not a wrench. And I get that. And then, by contrast, the guy with the older Ferraris, he was a wrench, you know. And in fact, he was an airplane pilot. And I said, who'd you fly for? And he said, I can't remember the name of the company, but it was a large charter company, one of the largest ones in the United States back in the day. And I jokingly said Eastern or National, and because they're Florida airlines. And he just chuckled after that one. And they're both defunct, by the way. And but the older vintage car guys tend to get their hands dirty and wrench on cars. The newer car guys don't do that. And that's not to say that they didn't back in the day. It's just that, you know, it comes a point in your life, I guess. You know, it's just like I still mow my lawn, and I know a lot of friends of mine that are a lot younger than me, than a little bit more affluent, or far more affluent, I should say. They don't mow their lawn anymore. They don't enjoy fussing with a lawnmower that sometimes wants to work and sometimes doesn't. I mean, heck, my lawnmower is, what, 20-some-odd years old, and I'm constantly nursing it. But it's kind of a weird thing. Cause
gas, like, or electric?
Gas, of course. Absolutely gas. Actually, I was looking for diesel. You know, if I could find a diesel lawnmower, I'd get And then here's the other thing I do. I actually go out of my way, and I mow my yard late in the evening just so I can annoy my neighbors. A lot of guys are getting these zero turns while we're on the subject of lawnmowers. Well, I had just the old school style tractor. But to me, it's, you know, when you're relaxing, you know, you're cutting the lawn and you're smelling like cut grass, and it's just kind of neat, you know. And but, you know, it's like the old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And I guess I'm still an old dog, or as Mike used to call me all the time, my good buddy, he'd call me a dinosaur. He says, Robert, you're just a dinosaur. You just won't change. And I go, yep. Anyway, so Festival of Speed was a really, really good event. Some real interesting cars. Yes, there was a lot of late model cars there. There was a lot of Challengers, a lot of Corvettes. There was a lot of foreign JDM cars there, a few of those. Vintage Porsche, a really nice vintage 1953 Jaguar fixed head that was just almost concourse quality, almost too nice to drive. And every once in a while, that's the whole thing, is like you go to these car shows, and if the car, what's the point? If the car's too nice to drive, it just becomes, you know, another, you might as well just hang it on the wall, you know? I get the climate control garage, and I get them, you know, stacking them on double stacked garage lifts and things like that. That's all fine and dandy, but I mean, it's nice to go out there and you know, drive them. You know, that's what they're intended for. Of course, on the other hand, half the stuff I got to go out and spend a day or two fixing them before I can take them out for a drive. But that's part of the what's the word I'm looking for? The charm of owning a vintage or classic car, you know. And this is why vintage races, and a big shout out to, there's a number of events coming up here in the next couple of weeks. We've got the Chattanooga Concourse coming up. I think it's the first week in October, we've got the Barber Motorsports Vintage Festival, which is the big motorcycle thing up in Birmingham, Alabama. At the end of the month in October is the Audrain Concourse. That's going to be a lot of fun. HSR's got an event going on, or they just had it. They got another one coming on here in a little bit, but they, I think they just had one at Atlanta, and they got another one coming up. So when you go to these vintage car events, it's, you know, there's you know the two guys. There's just this vibe. You just kind of like, I'm gonna, you know, hang out with the guys at Tanker, and you know, some of these guys are pretty good at it, especially if you own a Ferrari and you got six Webers on there. You need to know what you're doing. Right, Alan, if you're listening? Anyway, on that note, we're going to play a song or some music, and then we're going to get a special guest on for the evening, right? And this theme needs no introduction. I'm sure you all know this one, and you're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
Posey, racing driver, writer, architect. Tune in for Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, we're back, and you're tuning into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Thanks, Sam. I'm delighted to welcome back to the show for part two the lovely and always talented Lady Pat Bondurant, and the widow of racing legend Bob Bondurant, who's also a friend of mine. So, Pat, how you doing this evening?
I am wonderful, and hello from sunny Scottsdale, Arizona.
Sunny Scottsdale, Arizona, yep. I wish I was there. It's actually nice and dry out there, but it's getting drier here, too, in Florida.
Yeah. We're in the 80s now. Hallelujah.
Yeah, here as well. So, I played that theme song because you wanted to share a story with us because, you know, and I touched on this earlier, you know, about, because I played the clip to Ford versus Ferrari, and I kind of emphasized that, you know, Ken Miles and Carroll Shelby had a relationship, but that's because he worked in-house, no different than Roger Penske and Mark Donohue did, as well as Kennedy and Ferrari back in the day, in the early days of Ferrari in the 50s. And Bob, I mentioned three drivers, Bob Bondurant, Phil Hill, and Dan Gurney, which, you know, Mario Andretti and Parnella Jones, outstanding drivers, but rawhide. Ken Miles was a little fluid, but he tended to be hard on, you know, stuff a little bit from time to time. But when you talk, and I remember talking to Dan Gurney about this, Dan Gurney, Bob Bondurant, and Bob said this to me as well, these guys were extremely fluid drivers and preserved equipment, and yet still won like crazy. So it's all about the driving style, correct?
It is. You know, I love the story where when I was in Dan Gurney's office, and he said, he used to call me Peach.
Peach?
I don't know if it's because I'm from the South or what it was, but he would say, Peach? He said, I want you to, for history's sake, when you write Bob's book, that you put that I was his number one student in his class. And I said, well, I know you went through when you started bat racing with NASCAR. He said, no. He said, in 1964, going through Le Mans, he said, I'd raced four times and never finished once. And he said, Bob pulled me to the side and said, listen, if you'll just take care of the equipment, we can win this thing. We can finish this race. Be smooth. Don't knock the gears into place. Just, you know, pretend like it's an egg. And to the end of time, Bob would teach you in school to hold that gear shift head like it was an egg. And you didn't want to crush it by jamming it. And as you might know, most DNFs went out because gearboxes.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's all about taking care of the equipment, 100%.
The song, because one of the things we wanted to talk a little bit about, and a lot of people, and this is kind of like true for a lot of race car drivers, a lot of them were aviators, pilots.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So tell us about Bob.
Well, when you ask what song would I like, and I said, why don't you play Top Gun?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason Top Gun is, first of all, he trained Tom Cruise.
Okay.
Bob Mondragon trained young Tom Cruise for Days of Thunder. Then Bob also trained the Blue Angels, and he flew with the Blue Angels. Bob had his own fixed-wing license. He used to fly a what he called a little hot rod airplane called a Mooney.
Yeah, with the backward tail fin.
Yep, that he would land on the Willow Springs racetrack and go test drive the Cobras and the Mustangs. And then he had his commercial helicopter pilot license for about well over 45 years. And, you know, at the end of the day, if I was going to pick a song for Bob Bondurant, it would be Top Gun, because he was racing's Top Gun, in my opinion.
Super, super. So give us some more stories. You know, tell us about how the legend, how his mind worked a little bit when it was coming to the to the racing, you know, and did he ever share with you, you know, let's say like some of the strategies that he would have to, you know, think about ahead of time, and who he considered, and like in that little interview that we did, that we played last week, you know, when he said, where the comment was when the British guy says, how come you didn't wait for us? And he goes, wait for you. I don't know about you, but in America, we play to win.
That's right. That's
and
right.
So did Bob consider, when he went out there to race, he was just focused on one thing, winning. Did he worry about other drivers?
You know, Bob had the power of positive thinking. He already drove the race in his head before he went to sleep every night. He replayed the whole track. And then just prior to a race, he would get in his car and relax and close his eyes and retrace the track one more time. And then he would visualize himself on the podium. And it was the power of positive thinking, which was one. But number two, you got to have talent. You can't just, oh, I think I'm going to win today because I manifested it. No, it's part of the equation. But he did share with me that when he first got to Europe, he was watching the tip-top drivers. And they were, you know, the Jimmy Clarks and the you know, the Jochen Rents and the Mastin Gregories and the, you know, the just all the cool Graham Hill. I mean, you can't get any better than these guys. So he would sit up in the stands and watch them at each turn during their practice laps. And he learned when they would brake and when they would accelerate. And he also learned how, where to pass. So he would say, go into the turn slow, get under your driver, and go out fast. So, and there's no question, when you went through his school, you learned every single nuance that every driver that he ever came up against not only used against him, but he learned and used against them. You know, it's definitely physics, talent, guts, your boy, balls, you know. But, you know, and he also said one thing. He said, if you ever got in your race car and worried, is this the day I'm going to die? He said, you had no business getting behind that wheel. It was always getting in that car and saying, this is the day I'm going to win.
When did he ever talk about safety? Did he ever have a concern about, you know, because back in the day, and you touched on this last week, that, you know, it was almost like every weekend a driver was getting killed, okay?
Yeah.
And so in the 1965 Le Mans, his co-driver was Schlesser. And Schlesser, unfortunately, later met his demise at Spa or someplace like that. I'm not sure. It was a fiery crash. And but when you talk to some of the guys and you look at the cars, okay, that they built back then, they weren't exactly safe.
No, they were ticking time bombs. They were big gas petroleum bombs that, you know, behind their heads. With no seatbelts. You know, it wasn't until Jackie Stewart and Bob were racing Formula One against each other, and Jackie went off the track, and because the water, he hydroplaned on it. Well, Bob, not seeing the water, had come across the road, and he hit it, and he spun out and went off on the other side. So his Formula One car is upside down, and the villagers flip him upright and say, Stewart. And so Bob climbs up the bank, runs across the road. There's Jackie Stewart pinned in his car by his own steering wheel with gas up to his waist.
Oh, my.
And there was no ambulances. There was no way to get Jackie out, soaking in fuel that, let's face it, that's what killed these guys. One spark would have ended it all for Bob and Jackie. Bob runs to the nearest barn, says, give me a toolbox, runs back to Jackie's car. By this time, Graham Hill has shown up. Bob is unscrewing the steering wheel. So today, thanks to Jackie Stewart, you have snap-off steering wheels. But back then, Bob had to unscrew the wheel to get Jackie out of that death trap and drag him over to the side. And Jackie Stewart will give Bob Bondurant the credit every day, every book he writes, every interview he writes, on saving his life, and he therefore could go forward with safety rules. These guys, it was insane what these guys put up with, but they loved it. They didn't care.
Well, you know, I never heard that story before. That's a fascinating story, you know. And
yep.
and you're right, because Jackie Stewart, particularly in the 70s, really got, you know, heavily involved in safety and Formula One and everything.
Yeah,
but I remember I was looking at one of the Ford GTs, GT40s, and as well as the Cobras, as well as the Daytona Coupe. And if you look in there, there's really, I mean, you have maybe a few bars and a rollover bar, but that's it, you know. And if that car, you know, when those cars crashed, I mean, they basically folded up. And one guy told me, he says, Robert, you got to understand that the sponsors, the engine builders, the car builders, all the big money, a driver was just there for, he was fodder, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he was out there for fame and glory, you know, and if he could win, but he was expendable. And if that driver got killed, there's two more in line to get in that race car the next time.
Here's one last safety story. So Bob leaves Formula One because he finds out that the Peter Revson was one of his best friends. And he said, hey, Bob, they're racing these cars in a Can-Am series, and they're even faster than the Formula One. Let's leave our Formula One contract, Bob being Ferrari, and let's go back to America. Let's go race those cars. Well, they got McLaren. And here's where safety comes in. So Bob's out there doing practice laps and qualifying and, you know, doing great. It was a McLaren Mark II. And the night after he came in from qualifying, they took the car apart and checked everything. Well, the mechanic's son, teenager, saw the red mark on the right steering arm and wiped it off and didn't show it to his dad. It already had a fracture in it. So he goes back on the car, and the mechanic told Bob, you know, he felt guilty his whole life for this. So they put the steering arm back on the car, and at 150 miles an hour, Bob Bondurant goes the steering arm brakes at 150, flips in eight times end over end. Bob said he remembers being so high in the sky that he could see down over his shoulder the tops of the trees.
Oh.
So, and also, why were his feet and ankles crushed, completely crushed? Because the entire metal floor pan rolled back like a sardine can, completely rolled back and exposed his legs. So after that accident, then safety went in. You can't even imagine the difference in between the floor plans from that race before to that race after. And Bob was pronounced dead at that accident. So he was spared, as I told you in the other show, to start that school with his conversation with God. But the point is, it's even human error. It's not just, you know, a spark came out, set the, you know, the fuel tank on fire and, you know, the guy burned up. I mean, this is what frustrated Bob in today's world. He said, because he got to know Sebastian Vettel and Mark Webber and Hamilton, and, you know, we were down there in the paddocks with all these Formula One drivers up till 2018. And he said the thing that frustrated him the most was trying to compare what the drivers in Formula One did in 1966, but here's his era, to the guys now. It's so sanitized now. It's so computerized. You know, you've got water fluid going through your suit, keeping you cool. You got a sippy cup at your mouth. You got your guys in your headphones going, turn left, turn left. Slow down. You know, I mean, he's like, wait a minute. That has just sanitized the art of racing. So if he had a frustration, it was because of safety. It got so automated, and you really left out that when men were men. Not that they're not men now racing, because there's nothing unscary about Formula One drivers now, but you can see his point.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I don't know how many modern-day drivers could throw themselves in a real true vintage race car and be competitive with someone like Bob Bondurant.
Let me tell you what they couldn't handle. They would not be able to handle the heat those guys endured. They would not be able to handle the noise. I asked Bob, I said, honey, when did you lose your hearing? And he said, I'll never forget that day. He said, I was at Road Atlanta. He said, my car, probably the gearbox went out. He said, I'm walking down pit lane with my helmet. A Ferrari V12 pulls in. The guy collapsed right there in pit lane. The team owner yelled, hey, Bob, jump in. Bob, without putting his earplugs in, throws his helmet on. This is what you could do back then.
Oh, yeah.
Jumps in this guy's Ferrari. Now, keep in mind, he's behind and he's last. Bob Bondurant catches every single car, is in the lead, is about 100 yards from the finish line, and he runs out of gas.
Oh.
But that's a typical Bob story. But my point about that story is that V12 is right behind his head with no earplugs. Can you imagine today's driver? I can't even tell you. I don't even want to be disrespectful to how bad they would cry and throw a tantrum at having to hear that sound in their head for hours. So, no, I don't think they could handle what those guys went through.
Well, you know, I will say one thing about cars today, and in particular Formula One, which is much better than it used to be. Same thing with drag racing. Same thing with NASCAR in particular, and the GT cars. And when you see these cars, when they endure some of these amazing crashes, and the drivers just get up and walk out, that's, to me, is...
Well, that's amazing, and I'm thankful for that.
Yes.
But back to safety... Bob's race suit was paper-thin cotton. Today's race suits are flame retardant, including the threads that they're sewn with. But what they were given back in the 60s was a box of flame retardant solution. They would put their race suits in their bathtubs in the hotel. They would sprinkle the flame retardant solution.
Never heard this before.
In the water. And then they would hang their suit up with the flame retardant stuff in the fabric. And they would have to do that every race.
No kidding.
Yes, I'm telling you, when I buried Bob, he and I had a conversation when I had to really pull his ears off when he was out on the racetrack with Adam Carolla, and they were doing laps, and Adam was filming for one of his movies, and I black flagged Bob because I could hear the engine ticking, okay, in his GT40. And I'm like black flagging and getting in, and he was going, he was already in his 10th hot lap, right? And I'm like, oh, okay, this has got to stop. So I pull him in, and he pulls over to the side, and Adam goes, I think we're in trouble. And Bob gets out, and he goes, sweetheart, what is wrong? I said, Bob, 10 laps in that car is too much. The engine, I can hear it ticking when you're going past me. And I said, and you are fatigued. You have been at this all day in this heat. And he goes, what's wrong with that? And I go, oh, my God, how embarrassing would it be if Bob Bondurant died on his own racetrack in his own car? And he looked at me, and I hope everybody is just leaning into this. Do you know what Bob Bondurant said to me?
Go ahead.
He says, sweetheart, that would be the best way to go of any way I could think of on Earth.
Yes. Coming from a race car driver, I'm dying what I want to do best. What I want to do, I mean, what matters to me. Yeah, no, I understand.
In a race car on his own track, at his own will, I mean, that was it. He said, oh, my God. He said, that would be the best way to go I could ever dream of. I'm like, what? So I completely changed the wife mindset of always trying to protect him and just let him go. And it was great. You know, whether he was on a motorcycle, and this is up till he's 85 years old. He was like 84 when we had Adam at the school. So,
wow.
No. Safety is everything. So, but you know what? And his famous line was, when your number's up, it's up.
Hmm. That's true.
That's what Bob would say.
So, I know you were involved in a school. Did you do any? Were you involved in anything on the instruction side? Did you drive a lot yourself? Did you ever do any vintage racing or club racing or anything like that yourself?
I did not. I was the president and the CEO. I ran operations. I designed the Bondurant cars. When you saw the Bondurant to the Today Show came to Bondurant and they filmed the cars, and their topic was driving under the influence. And so I watched the show, and the cars were going by so fast you couldn't see the Bondurant name. And I looked at Bob and I said, honey, not at no time did they let you see that the car was a Bondurant car, and it was Corvettes at the time. And he goes, yeah, what's your point? And I said, can I design the new decals for the next fleet of school cars, the new Corvettes that were coming? He said, sure. So I took Bondurant from one end of that Corvette to the other as big as I could. And I said, now you can see it from a small airplane.
There you go.
So, but I did, the most amazing thing I've done in my life was walk beside the world champion every day of his life and watch him live his life to the fullest. And teaching students how to drive the way he learned as becoming a champion. His quote is, My life has been lived in two halves. The first half was becoming a world champion, and the second half was training the world to become champions.
Interesting.
So that was the love. The school was his other wife.
Okay.
And as long as I understood that, that marriage was a marriage made in heaven.
Okay. One of your former students, this is probably before your time, but and I know this gentleman became a very successful race car driver at some point in time, too. Does the name Terry Borscheller ring a bell?
Oh, Terry was one of our instructors.
Yes.
So many, and I adore that man, many of our instructors went on to become extremely successful race car drivers. Johnny O'Connell with the Corvettes, Darren Law, who now currently is part owner of the Flying Lizard. Rice. What's Rice's first name that won Indy 500? Buddy Rice.
Okay.
I mean, these are all Bondurant instructors that came to the school. Bob trained them how to be an instructor. And one by one by one by one, they got picked up by sponsors and went out and took on the world and won. But Terry Borscheller, my God, gentleman of gentlemen and race car driver extraordinaire and such an exemplary example of a Bondurant instructor.
And also to his credit, if I remember correctly, he won Le Mans in the Saleen S7.
Terry may have.
I believe he did.
I know he was the, wasn't he the, well, I know he's won many of the cups.
Yes.
Yeah, many cups. He's just, his list of accolades is longer than my leg, and that's a long leg. But no. Why, have you met Terry?
Oh, yeah.
I know he lives in Florida.
Yeah. Well, I used to crew on a team that was owned by an attorney in Tampa, and Terry was one of the drivers. And that's when I met him. We started talking a little bit, and somehow we got on the subject about vintage cars and Shelby's and Bosses and this and that. And then he mentioned, well, I went to school at Bob Bondurant, and I was one of the driving instructors there. And even back then, he said, you need to get out to California. And this is back when he was still in Sonoma. And He said, you need to get out there and do that course. You know, now, I got my racing license at Road Atlanta, and Steve Perner was my instructor back then, and I went through the course up there, and that was in 1990. But I always wanted to go, and to this day, I regret not sitting right next to Bob Bondurant, and even if I just rode with him, that would have been priceless.
And that did touch. I mean, I've had grown men choke up and get to where they had to swallow the lump in their throat telling me, all I got to do is ride in a hot lap. And it was the greatest moment of my life, knowing, and Christian Bale said that. He goes, knowing that I was in the car getting hot laps from the world champion made me emotional in the car while we were going. I mean, it does do. Bob was not of this world. That's the only thing I can explain. And the men that he touched with his training and his savvy and, you know, look up the word savant. That is what Bob Bondurant was. He was a racing savant. And nobody will dispute that. You know, the Bondurant School was always acclaimed as the global expert on driver training and safety. Global expert. And, you know, all my instructors are on standby. I mean, this economy has just suffocated any chances of getting the school to a new home. And I'm just crossing my fingers this election makes some changes in the economy and we can go forward, because I have got employees and instructors. You know, they all call me mom, and they're like, mom, I can't handle my life the way it is. I work in a dealership, for God's sake. You know, my Bondurant shirt hangs on my drawers in my, you know, my bedroom suit. Like, it's waiting. And I'm like, I know. So, but some of his instructors were his, one in particular, his name is Joe Williams. Joe Williams, without any question, no disrespect to all the other fantastic instructors, but Bob always said, that guy right there is the best instructor I've ever had. So Joe and I have gone through you know, Bob wrote 5 books on driving, so we've gone through them and we've updated them, and so I'm trying to get that new, you know, which includes electric cars, unfortunately.
Oh.
Unfortunately. But, you know, you got to, I mean, if you're going to train people how to drive, they got to know how to handle torque.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
You know?
Well, that brings, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, that brings a question. How do you determine, because like in the early days in Sonoma, I think he pretty much had Fords, right, were his school cars.
Yeah.
And then I think when you moved out to Arizona, I think there were General Motors cars at one point in time.
Well, the Mustangs moved out here with Bob.
Okay.
And he moved here in 1989. And in what year would that have been? 2003. It is a story that's going in the book on how the world woke up to WTF. What happened between Bondurant and Ford? Well, yeah. It was a new president came in and told Bob who he was going to sell the school to and for how much. Bob said, excuse me, but I don't think you understand this. That school is my life, and my life is not for sale, Mr. New Ford president, who only lasted a couple of years.
That was was that Jack Nasser or was that McNally or whatever his name was? Did I say something wrong?
I think he was the president when they bought the Ford? Jaguar. Yeah, when they bought Jaguar.
Oh, that was that guy. That was Nasser.
Okay, whoever it was,
mm-hmm.
It didn't last very long, and he was very ill informed on how to approach Bob Bondurant, and unfortunately, it was one of Bob's very close friends that told Ford, I need you to get the school for me because I've got another project and I need to get the school out from under Bob. It's an unbelievable story.
Wow.
It's one of many, one of many. This book, you are going to sit there and go, shut up. That did not happen. Shut up. I mean, there's so many stories that, I mean, just the school alone is a movie. You know, I mean, Bob's racing career is like movie number one, which I'm in L.A. this weekend talking to producers, and I'm only halfway through the book.
Well, wait a minute. Now, since you're talking about movies, this brings up another question. We got about 6-7 minutes left.
Okay.
If someone had to play the role of Bob Bondurant and Pat Bondurant, who would you want to play those who would those characters be?
You know, I get asked that a lot. And Christian Bale said, he calls me Patty. He said, Patty, you know I want to play Bob. And I'm like, Christian, you're too old, baby. You're too old. And Bob was so hot. You know, just teasing Christian, of course. But, you know, I really have to look at the talent. Because whoever plays Bob, he has to be a gentleman above all. Because that comes through the inside and comes out. You have to be Hollywood handsome. You have to have manners. You have to be very polished. You have to be an international playboy.
Okay.
And I love the helmet of Bob's. Back in when Bob came back from Europe to the U.S., these were the days where they had a little, remember those little clicker guns that would write words on it,
uh-huh.
And then it was glue, and then
yeah.
Well, on the back of their helmets, it would say name, and it said Bondurant, and it said blood type, O, and it said sex, and Bob wrote yes. So that who could that character be? I mean, I really would have to look who has all the debonair qualities to be able to race, beat other drivers, and once the race is over, he's your best friend. I mean, he would go to his competitors. They all knew Bob. He didn't care that they had contracts that they were competitors. Once that race was over, he was your friend. And you can't do that in today's world, but you also have to have that kind of personality that you are a man's man to all men at all times. And, I mean, I don't know. I'd have to I really have to see what the talent pool looks like before I could say that's him. Because as his wife, I would have to be the one to kind of do the audition. Or, you know, show me what you got. Next.
Well, yeah, and then, of course, you would have to do cameos in the movie, of course.
Of course. I mean, can you tell that I love that man beyond explanation? And I've always told Bob, Bob goes, sweetheart, I'm so happy you love what I do. And I said, Bob, it's because I love you, and I am now a strawberry dipped in chocolate up to my stem in your racing world. And he just thought that was the greatest thing he'd ever heard.
That's
from
cool.
anyone.
That's a neat
yeah.
metaphor. Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and you know.
So what about? We have a few minutes left. You have to tell the Wernher von Braun story.
Oh, when I was at NASA.
Yes.
Okay, guys. Okay, listen up. So, I'm doing Ford commercials on TV in the South. I'm on Billboard. I get hired to be a draftsman for NASA. Wernher von Braun worked in Huntsville, Alabama, where I was working at NASA, and I got to go to his offices. And he sees me, and I mean, my grandmother was full German. He sees me across the room of 20 people. And he goes, you are German. And I go, why, yes, I am. And he says, come here, I'd like to show you something. And he told me to reach under his desk and hit a button. And when I did, these amazing louvered blinds, I'd never seen anything like this in my life. The first motorized blinds I'd ever seen, where it opens up these massive windows in his office. And we talked. He was fascinated that I was a draftsman on the first space shuttle, but he never called it the space shuttle. He kept calling it the moon ship.
Interesting.
I thought, wow. And I kept thinking, don't correct this man. Come on, 19-year-old. You know, don't correct him. But that is what he called the shuttle, was his moon ship. I just thought that was just really, really cool, you know? And, you know, and it's funny because when Bob knew that I'd worked on the first space shuttle, he said, you know, I always wanted to fly a spaceship. And I thought, man, I believe that. I believe that.
Pat, we are up against the clock. You have been an absolute hoot, as they say. And, I mean, your personality, your inflection, everything. It was a real treat to have you on the show. If people want to find out more about you, follow you, how do they go about doing it?
You know, the only silly thing I'm on is the Instagram. It's the real Pat Bondurant. I'm terrible on social media.
Mm-hmm.
I should keep Bob's updated. I need to get better about that. But that's really the only way to kind of keep up. And there's some really cool clips on the documentary I'm doing with Jim Marietta on the GT350 R, the competition Mustang that won the championships. While Bob's over in Europe winning the world, they're over here winning the championship. So I'm doing a documentary on that. You'll get to see clips of that on
okay.
The Real Pat Bondurant.
Pat, I want to thank you for coming out. We're just about out of time. We'll do this again in the future, maybe 3, 4, 5 months down the road. Have a great time out in California, and look forward to seeing you again in one of the future events. Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye. I want to thank all my listeners for tuning in to the Sales We're Going to Go on Cars. Don't forget, every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Tantalk Radio Network, right here. Stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.